I'm Ron Barr, and welcome to this special U.S. Airways in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. Sports Byline is America's sports talk show and heard on more than 200 U.S. radio stations, Sirius XM satellite radio, as well as worldwide on the Internet and the more than 500 stations of the American Forces Radio Network. On this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, we'll talk with Meadowlark Lemon, a sports legend who played on an iconic sports team, the Harlem Globetrotters. For 25 years, he toured the world with the Globies, bringing joy and laughter. Also, Joe Garagiola will join us. Garagiola is baseball's goodwill ambassador. His pro playing career started when he was just 16, and he's been in love with the game ever since. And we'll also talk with a war hero. Brian Stan went to the Naval Academy, served two tours in Iraq, was awarded the Silver Star for Valor, and is an up-and-coming mixed martial arts athlete. His story is unforgettable. So sit back and enjoy this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. First up, Meadowlark Lemon, the clown prince of basketball. Lemon grew up in North Carolina and overcame poverty, racial prejudice, and other roadblocks to become one of the sport's iconic and beloved athletes. He toured with the Harlem Globetrotters for 25 years and played in more than 16,000 games. He and his teammates played in over 100 countries and before popes, kings, queens, and presidents. He wrote about the ups and downs of his extraordinary life in the book, Trust Your Next Shot, A Guide to a Life of Joy. I started by asking him what impresses him the most about what he's done.
People. People are wonderful. And they come after me every day, you know, when I'm in the streets, going to the store. The people in the neighborhood where I live, you know, they respect my privacy. But the people in the groceries, the supermarkets, and when I hit the gym, you know, they just come up to me and thank me for the joy that we've given them over the years. You know, and most of the presidents that have been in office, they've called us the ambassadors of goodwill in short pants, which was a pretty good thing. And I think, you know, with you going over to the troops and everything, I think you have the same impact that we have, and that is bringing joy to those who are out in harm's way.
What is it that you have found over the many years of playing basketball, the way you played basketball, that really makes it the universal vehicle for people?
Well, it's just the laughter. Everyone wants to laugh, man. Everybody needs to laugh. You know, and when we do something funny on the basketball court, people just roll out of their seats. You know, there was a game we played in Columbus, Ohio years ago, and we played at the old fairgrounds, and we didn't have any standing room. And I don't know how this man got these two chairs right in between the baskets, and because the basket was sitting in a funny position, and this little kid was laughing. He's laughing. You could hear him all over the place. And a ball got missed the ball, I guess. And it rolled down in his feet. And I picked it up. I said, I'm going to have some fun with this kid. And I threw the ball at him, and it hit him in the chest. And I said, boy, can't you catch it? And I picked it up, and I threw it to him again. It hit him in the chest again. And the gentleman that was with him, he said, Meadowlark, I'm his uncle, and I brought him here. I'm telling him everything you're doing because he can't see a thing. And I said, man, that is something. You know, we're making a blind kid laugh. That's really, really something. And these are the things that make me happy when I see a young child who is full of joy.
Let's go back to the early years of Meadowlark Lemon. You grew up in North Carolina. It was a difficult life, but yet it is one that fashioned you into the man that you ultimately became. Take me back to what the early years were like for Meadowlark Lemon, because you talk about it in the book.
Yes. You know, I spent a lot of time with my aunt and my grandmother and my dad. He was in and out. My mom, you know, they were separated, and she lived in New York, and I love New York. But it gets cold there, and it don't get quite as cold in North Carolina. So I spent most of the time in North Carolina, and when it got a little warmer, but I'd go up north. But I had a childhood that that's better than most. You know, my family didn't have a lot of money. In fact, we didn't have any money. But you know, they would go fishing every day. And they would bring back always a good catch. And they grew their own chickens and everything else was really, really inexpensive. So we ate real well. Other than that, you know, we didn't know anything about anything else. and we didn't have television. Not too many people had television then. And we would go to the movie house every weekend, and we would get the news from last week. And I saw these young men from Chicago on a basketball court. And that's when I got my vision. It didn't come from television, but my vision came from a movie house. I saw the Harlem Globetrotters, and something happened on the inside of me. There were a lot of kids in the movie house that day, but none of them saw what I saw. I guess they all saw them with their spirit, with their natural eyes, and I saw them with my spiritual eyes, which comes from within. And I ran home that day to learn how to play basketball. When I got home, I found out I had no place to play. So I made my own basket out of a coat hanger and an old onion sack. My first basketball was a Carnation milk can. So now we can't put down small beginnings, because with the coat hanger, the onion sack, and a Carnation milk can, we've carried basketball all over the world.
Those were the early years, of course, but tell me about the path that ultimately led to you being one of the Harlem Globetrotters in 1955.
Oh, gosh, there's so many things happened there. You know, there's a man by the name of Marcus Haynes, I guess. Marcus is the greatest dribbler, possibly point guard of all time. He did it all. And Marcus was just, he was so quick, he was so fast. It looked like he wasn't running. It looked like he was gliding across the floor. And he was told to take a look at me. And you got to realize, I'm coming from a small community, and in my high school, the most we ever had to look at us in a game was about 500 people. Well, he took a look at me and told me, gave me a uniform and said, "Let me see what you got." In Raleigh, North Carolina, with 15,000 people. You know, I was scared, but I knew that I was prepared to do what I had to do. And that started it all off. But then I went into the armed forces for 2 years. And then when I came out, there was a job waiting for me with the Globetrotters. And that's when I took off. Things just started happening for me. And I've been a blessed person all of my life because of the vision that I had when I was 11 years old in the Ritz Theater.
Was the Harlem Globetrotters the only path for black basketball players at that time? Because the NBA was, that wasn't a path necessarily at that time for the black ball player?
Well, actually, when I first saw them, that was the beginning of the NBA. And the Globetrotters had been around for a few years. When I got on the team in 55, there was only about five black players in the NBA at the time. Bill Russell had just gotten there, and he was basically taking over everything then because he was so good, so much better than most of us, that he just took over the game himself. That's when ball players started coming into to the NBA. He had a young man who played against me in high school by the name of Sam Jones. And Bill Russell, he has 10 fingers, but he has 11 championship rings. Sam Jones was with him, so Sam has 10 championship rings. So this was the beginning of a lot of things for the black ball players coming into the NBA.
How did the choreography of the way the Globies played come about? Because they were serious ball players, but yet when they went and visited, did they understand that this is the way they had to play because of the social times that they were playing in?
I don't think so. I think that there were so many things happened. Most of the Globetrotters during that time were also real great baseball players. And in fact, Ted Strong, who played, he was one of the greatest Globetrotters of all time, they sought him out before they sought Jackie Robinson out because he was so good. But at the time when they were playing up in the Dakotas, and when the season ended, he said that he wanted to stay up there for a while, and he did, and they couldn't find him. But all of the guys, Bruce Tatum, they were really great baseball players, Sam Wheeler, all of those guys, this was their first sport. And basketball, when they started playing basketball, well, certain things started happening. You know, there was only five of them. And I think I was told when they were playing against local teams all over the country, well, not all over the country, because they call them the Harlem, associated with the borough of Harlem, New York, because most black people lived in Harlem. Globetrotters, because they hoped to travel throughout the state of Illinois. So they were just playing basketball against anybody in the state of Illinois, and that's the way it basically happened. They would get tired, and one guy would fall down the floor and start dribbling while everybody else rest. And, you know, they'd pass the ball behind their back. And that's where it all started. And when I came along, I just kind of pushed it up a notch. And I did a few more things with passing the ball between my legs, behind my back, pinning the ball against people's chests and shooting it between their legs and stuff like that.
Meadowlark Lemon has joined us on Sports Byline. Again, we're talking about his book, Trust Your Next Shot, A Guide to a Life of Joy, Clown Prince of Basketball. And anybody that ever saw the Globies when he was playing or anywhere along in their life certainly never forget the moment that they saw them. Every year when you would come to town, my parents would take me out, and I remember those wonderful moments. I'm just wondering, how did black people feel about the Harlem Globetrotters?
Oh, gosh, if there was mixed emotions, mostly great emotions, even now. You know, I speak a lot. I speak about 150 times a year across the country. And when I go into certain neighborhoods, you know, a lot of people stick their chest out and say, yeah, look who we brought to town. I don't care who you got, but look who we brought to town. And I believe that the times that we lived in the beginning, I think America needed someone like us, not just for black people, but for all people, all Americans, because, you know, when we would go into certain cities, you know, they just opened their doors for us. When we would go to places like Los Angeles, then we were like the Lakers are today. And especially in New York, you go to New York City, everybody came out, I mean, from all walks of life. And we were then the American team, the American group of people who brought them joy.
You know what I find interesting? If you take a look at the history, certainly Abe Saperstein was so important to the Globies' history. And here is a white Jew working with black athletes. How did that marriage work?
Oh, gosh, it always worked all kinds of ways. There were times there was mixed emotions. There were times when I met Abe for the first time, and I just talked to his daughter, Eloise Saperstein, a couple of hours ago, and she reminded me the first time that we met was in Karlsruhe, Germany, and I came in and I met her dad for the first time, and I was scared. You know, this little young, I was just a teenager in the Army, and he was sitting down on the bench when I walked in with my Army uniform on, and I spoke to him just for a couple of minutes, not much. And she said, when I walked away from her dad, he said, honey, baby, this is the guy I've been looking for. He is the next star of the Harlem Globetrotters. And it just took off from that point.
When you think about the time in which you and the Globies played, that was back in the mid-50s, and of course that time was not particularly tolerant in this country. What did you see about the country that the way you guys played basketball, the way you visited cities that may otherwise not be tolerant of minorities and African Americans, what did you note about the country at that time, Meadowlark?
You know, there were so many things going on in the country. You know, there were, you know, we were having wars all over the world. And people needed something to laugh about. They needed something to laugh with. And we were it. You know, we were, you know, Joe Louis was still around. And later on, Muhammad Ali, he came on the scene. And, you know, and the charisma that he brought into boxing and entertainment, you know, was second to none. And then there we were, you know, we were playing basketball, and we would play against anybody. In fact, you know, one time we had two teams on the road, but we had six teams traveling against us, alternating every night playing against us. So every town we went into, we were the home team. Even when we played against the local teams, you know, people cheered for us and didn't cheer for their home team. So we were the, you know, America at the time were looking for something that they could hang their hat on, something that they could laugh about, someone that they could laugh with. And we were chosen. You know, I wish it was like that today. I wish someone would come up with something like we did in those days so they could laugh about the joy that we have in our world. And, you know, I tell people that I am the American dream. You know, ever since that day in the movie house in the Ritz Theater in Wilmington, North Carolina, I could dream. I began to dream, and I had a vision about where I was going. And 7 years later, can you imagine? 7 years later, coming from not ever seeing a basketball game, not ever picking up a basketball, I was playing with the greatest team of all time, the Harlem Globetrotters.
Did you have to be sensitive about the way you played the local teams and not to embarrass them in any way?
Well, they didn't look at it as being embarrassed in most cases. You know, every now and then you find a kid who, you know, had his whole family in the gym, and he wanted to do well. But, you know, there were, I remember a young man who played with the New York Knickerbockers, Dave DeBuscher. We played against Dave on the College All-American Tour. You know, and he and I became pretty good friends during that tour. And I told him the first time we were getting ready to put the show on, I said, "Dave, man, play somebody else because we're getting ready to put the show on." He said, "No, go ahead, put it on. Put it on me. I want to see it too." and a lot of those people that we played against, you know, we jokingly told them, "You know, y'all have to go out and get a ticket because y'all having more fun than anybody in the building."
You know, small town America is always a unique experience. And I'm wondering, as you did travel across this country from coast to coast and border to border, what are some of the favorite small towns that you played in and some of the experiences you had in them?
Oh, God, yeah, they were all great. You know, to really try to pick out one, you know, it would almost be impossible. Because everybody, we played in a little town in Iowa. I can't even remember the name of the town now. They had 2,000 people in the little town we played in. But we had to play two games because 4,000 people came out. We don't know where they came from, but they came from all over the place. You know, the farmers, you know, they would drive miles to see us play. And one town I remember in particular, I can't remember the name right now, but there was a man, he said he drove 2 hours with his son and his daughter, and they only had enough money for one ticket. So what he did was he gave his son the money to buy one ticket, and at halftime he passed the stub out to his sister, and she came in and watched the second game. But he said he stood out. And he just listened to the laughter and the joy that was going on in the inside. And he said they went home rejoicing because they were so happy that they got a chance to have fun together.
We got a couple minutes before we have to break here, but did you note anything about this country and the different parts of the country as to their attitudes about just general attitudes toward life, or was it something that was the same across the country?
It was basically the same across the country. You know, in the bigger cities, you know, places like New York City. Well, New York City is New York City. There's no other place like it, you know. And when we would come to San Francisco, we would spend 2 weeks in San Francisco and 4 weeks in Los Angeles. So we had a lot of fun there on the West Coast, and everything just happened really well for us.
Also, when you think about the international travel that the Globies had as well, what was the first time? Where was the first place that you went internationally with them?
Well, that's when I met Abe for the first time. I was in the Army in Austria, Salzburg, Austria. And it was very difficult for me to fly into Germany, into Karlsruhe. So the general there, he flew me in to Karlsruhe, Germany, and he said, I'll see you in 30 days, because I was on a furlough. So Karlsruhe, Germany was the next best place. And then when I was stationed in Austria, you know, the Globetrotters would come to Europe, and they would pick me up and keep me for a couple of weeks, and then I'd have to go back and soldier.
But I have always heard that the Globies playing over in Europe, it was a fascination for Europeans to see tall black men. Did you notice that?
Did I notice that? The first game that Will Chamberlain played with us was in Milano, Italy. And I called him the Big Dipper. And we were just walking down the street, and people were coming out of the stores and trying to figure out what kind of circus is coming to town. You see these two black guys, 1'6" and the other 7'2". They never seen anything like that before. But now it's what happened in the world today, because one of the Italian ball players who went into the Hall of Fame with me, he said he saw me in a little town in Italy when he grew up. He said, and after seeing me, he wanted to play basketball, but he also wanted to play the pivot. He wanted to play center, and he grew to be 7 feet tall. So this is a good thing that happened for not only for America, but for the world.
Meadowlark, I've heard a story that the Globies had two uniforms that were always available. One was for Wilt Chamberlain. The other was for Bill Cosby. Is that a true story?
That's a true story. I was there. You know, and it wasn't a publicity stunt, anything like that, because they would just show up. It wasn't a thing where people said, well, they're marketing Will Chamberlain or Bill Cosby. They would just show up, and we put them in uniform. And I guess I would say there are probably three. There are a lot of great players, but when you kind of, if you can narrow it down to maybe, Will Chamberlain, Bill Russell, and my homeboy, Michael Jordan. You know, those, if you're going to narrow it down to three people, they would be the three people. And people all over the world would come out and see the three. You know, Michael and I come from the same hometown. So I helped carry the game of basketball around the world. And after that, Michael picked it up, and he put it on his shoulder, and he continued to carry basketball around the world.
A lot of people do not know that Wilt Chamberlain did play with the Harlem Globetrotters. How did he end up with the Globies?
Well, you know, he came out of school his junior year, and at that time, I think the highest player in the NBA made $25,000 a year. Well, when Wilt came with us, Abe Saperstein saw something that he could market, and he gave Chamberlain $75,000, which was unheard of. And the next year, he went into the NBA, and he wanted $100,000 to play. And they told him, they came up with, I think, with $85,000, and they said, nobody will ever make $100,000 playing basketball. Well, you better talk to LeBron James because he's doing quite well.
Bill Russell is a friend of mine, and he was in the studio here with me one time, and we were talking about his book, and we started talking about Wilt Chamberlain, and a lot of people thought that they were adversaries, but they were anything but adversaries. They were good friends. Tell me a little bit about your favorite stories about Wilt Chamberlain.
Wilt Chamberlain. Abe Saperstein wanted Wilt to score 100 points one night, and Wilt didn't want to score 100 points. And Wilt decided that he was not going to cut across the pivot. And Abe didn't want to tell Wilt to cut. He came to me and said, well, Med, make him good. Well, how can I make Will Chamberlain good? He said, well, what you do is go out and pull him by the arm and make him cut, and you hand him the ball. I said, well, I'll be walking. He said, I don't care. Make him walk. And he said, make him come up anyway. Wilt got so mad. He caught that ball. He dunked it so hard, it went down through the bucket, hit the floor, and came back up, and then came back down again. And I said, is that okay? Because we got 4 points on that. And Abe had a big smile on his face. But Chamberlain was totally different. I never seen anybody like that. He's probably the strongest athlete that ever lived. And he could do so many different things. He's probably one of the greatest athletes of all time.
Al Addles was talking to me one time, and of course Al has that great line about that Wilt and Al Addles combined for 117 points one night in a game, and of course that was the game in Hershey, Pennsylvania, where he did score 100 points.
Yes, that is correct. And Addles, oh gosh, he's one of the top athletes of all time also, and not being the biggest basketball player of all time, you know, he didn't back away from anybody.
Yeah, Bill talked very fondly of the battles that he had with Wilt Chamberlain in the NBA because he said, you know, I could not match him up for size. He said, I had to outthink him. What is the biggest misconception about Wilt Chamberlain, the basketball player?
Well, I don't think people really realize how big and strong he was because, you know, when you look at him in different photos, it looked like, you know, that he was skinny. He was skinny, but he was big. He, you know, and I'm looking at a photo of Chamberlain, Curly Neal, and Geese Osby and myself. And I'm a little taller than the both of those guys, but I look like a little child sitting next to Chamberlain. That's how big he was, and people didn't realize. Not only was he big, but he was fast. You know, this man, and he was a high jumper at the same time. So he was a lot of things in one.
It's interesting when you look at the Harlem Globetrotters, and you just reeled off some of the great names along with yourself as well. And usually a franchise will die off. What has been the enduring factor about the Harlem Globetrotters?
America's team. And then it became the world's team. And no matter where we went and where they still go today, people still enjoy them. I am a minister also, and I go speak in a lot of churches. And there are times when some of the pastors will put a basketball up in the pulpit and ask them, throw me a ball, and say, now let me see what you can do. And I will go to the back of the church, and I'll shoot a long hook shot, and I said, that's what I can do.
One thing, too, is that when you guys traveled the world, the one thing I remember, and I used to see this when I'd see films of you guys traveling on different countries, you played in some very unusual venues. I think you played in a swimming pool one time, did you not?
Cologne, Germany. That is correct. And people would be in their homes, you know, on the 10th floor, 15th floor, and they would have their chairs out there watching us in the swimming pool. There was no water in there, but it was Olympic-sized swimming pool, and that's what we did. I guess I played in at least maybe over the years, maybe 100 bull rings around the country. In England and Ireland, we played in a lot of the soccer fields, you know, and when it started raining, well, Abe would tell us you can't quit because it's raining, because if you quit, we got to give the money back so nobody quit. So those are some of the places we played in the mountains of Austria and Italy. We had to play on ice one time, and it was so cold we had platoon systems. You know, each group would go up and play for about 3 or 4 minutes. We'd come back and downstairs and heat up, and then we'd go back up again.
Meadowlark Lemon, a man and an athlete who has touched millions of people around the world. Now on to baseball. Another athlete who loves the game he played and broadcasted is Joe Garagiola. Garagiola began his pro career when he was just 16. He played for 9 undistinguished years in the majors with the Cardinals, Pirates, Cubs, and Giants, but he did win a World Series championship with St. Louis. His greater accomplishment came in the broadcasting booth. He replaced longtime and beloved Yankee announcer Mel Allen, and for nearly 25 years he did the Game of the Week telecasts on NBC. Multi-talented, he also hosted the Today Show for more than 11 years. Baseball is not only Garagiola's passion, it's his love. And he shared that love with fans and readers in the book Just Play Ball. I asked Garagiola if it was true that a fan and his wife were the motivating forces behind his writing the book.
Well, they were, and then a little bit of myself, just a teeny bit. Let me run it down for you. Yeah, I sit in the stands because I buy a season tickets for my wife and me. I wasn't going to call a ball club and ask Joe for tickets every day. And so I buy them. And you know me, Ron, I talk to everybody, the foul pole, the groundskeeper, anybody that'll stop. And the guy sitting next to me, one day he says, "You ought to be a contest." I said, "What are you talking about being a contest?" He said, "Well, you tell me to look here and look there, and I don't see anything happening. Then I ask you why, and you tell me, and then I see what's happening. And if you were a contest, the winner could sit next to you at a baseball game." I said, "Well, that's very flattering." And then I save notes. I'm one of those guys, as you well know, that I'm a people guy. I don't think baseball is played by numbers. It's played by people. And if somebody tells me a funny story or a funny line, or a description that I like, I write it down and I put it in a drawer. And I had a drawer full, and I still do 15 games for the Diamondbacks. And sometimes when I'm in a little bit of a hurry and haven't really prepared like I should, and you know what I'm talking about because you're a preparer. And so I go in a drawer and I grab 2 or 3 of them, and it always worked out. My wife said, "Why don't you write a book about all that stuff?" I said, "That's all I need is another book." I said, "I'm fighting the tobacco guys, those insidious people for going after our kids. I got the Indians. We're trying to build a library, and you want me to write a book." And well, she said, "Gina would help you." That's my daughter, who's a fine writer in her own right. She writes for guideposts, religious-oriented pieces, and that's how I got going. And I'll tell you, it not only am I happy that it's taken off like it has, because it just makes you feel good, but I had a publisher friend, and I think this was the trend. When I gave it to him, he said, "Well, you know, the stories, they're funny, but it's your guys, and people don't remember them." I said, "Hey, John, what's the difference? A funny story is a funny story. I mean, if Babe Ruth or Willie Mays or Barry Bonds or Joe Bag of Donuts, it says the same story. If it's funny, it's funny." I said, "What you want, I could write that book in 10 minutes. He said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "I could write the book that you'd publish, and it would be, I found sex in the locker room and steroids in the trainer's room. You'd print it in a minute." And he said, "Well," I said, "I'm not that kind of guy." So that's the whole kit and caboodle. It doesn't have, I'm not going to win the Pulitzer Prize for it, Ron, but I think people will have fun reading it.
Yeah, what you say in the book is Just Play Ball is a book of funny stories, some pitching and hitting theories that might have you scratching your head, and funny one-liners said by guys who played the game hard but realized it wasn't life or death. Do you think the players today still realize it's not life or death?
Some of them do. The good ones do. Yeah, they can forget, and they're not taking advantage of the game. I think we got a guy on the Diamondbacks that probably shows it more than anybody, and that's that Eric Burns. I mean, he plays, he goes after balls, and last night, for example, he dove after a ball, which when you really saw the play, you said, "Ooh, why is he trying to catch it?" But he caught it, and the bases were loaded. If he misses it, I guarantee you, Dodgers scored 3 runs and maybe an inside-the-park home run. But that's the way you play it. You play it the best way you know how, and try to have fun with it.
There is the term gamers, and it doesn't apply to every player, Joe, but during the course of the time that you've either played this game or you've watched this game, what is the definition of a gamer?
A gamer is a guy that goes out there prepared, does the best he can, and when the game's over, leaves it in the clubhouse and realizes there's nothing you can do. He's not going to brood about it.
And the next day, he's going to prepare best he can for that particular game. I think that the gamer today is the guy who they say can play through an injury. You can't play through an injury. There are some guys who get a hangnail. I'll grant you, and they'll want an MRI and 2 weeks on a disabled list. But it's the difference between knowing an injury and just hurting a little bit. I mean, you can't. A knuckleball pitcher, for example, if he gets a hangnail, that's a serious injury. And you have to realize that. But there are some gamers. There are some gamers. I think you watch them on a double play. Do they try to take the guy out of the play? If they're an outfielder, do they stop at the warning track, realizing that the wall is so close and they got a guaranteed contract, so why get hurt? How fast do they take off, leaving the batter's box? You know, these guys today, that really upsets me is they'll hit a ball and then they'll want to watch it go into the stands and maybe hold a press conference.
Joe, one of the things that I remember in my discussion with Joe Morgan one night at dinner, we were talking about his love for the game and the background and everything. And I thought about you because growing up in St. Louis and across the street from obviously Yogi Berra, you guys grew up at a time where baseball was a part of the growing up culture. We don't seem to have that now. Do you think the appreciation that today's players have for the game and the way they play the game is dictated by the way they grew up with the game, whether they grew up with it or not?
Oh, I think it absolutely is dictated by the way they grew up. I mean, for us as kids, talking about Yogi and our Stags Club, River and Poochie and Nana and all the guys, the highlight of our month or whenever was when the widow, we used to call her the widow lady, would take two or three of us to the ballpark because we ran errands for her for the past week, and we'd get to sit in left field in the knothole gang, and we'd get to watch our favorite player. And in those days, with no television, I mean, we tried to figure out what was a Van Lingo Mungo, for example, or what did a Rabbit Moranville look like, and a Little Poison Wainer. You thought, and our favorite player, I'll never forget Franz Lock saying it, Ducky Wucky Medwig, the bulging biceps from Carteret, New Jersey. Man, we wanted to have bulging biceps, but we didn't know what they were. So, I mean, that's how you grew up. And the bubblegum cards, those were your best friends. As I write in the book, Ron, a kid today gets a bubblegum card. The first thing he does, he sticks it in plastic and makes sure that the edges don't get rounded. There's no creases in it. And then he goes to the Beckett Book of Prices and tries to find out how much it's worth. He's like he's a little miniature stockbroker.
But I remember Willie Mays telling me down at spring training one time around the batting cage, we were talking about the fact that baseball lends itself so wonderfully for the stories like the ones that you have here in your book, Just Play Ball. He says, and he laments the fact that you don't hear players around the batting cage really telling stories like they used to. Why do you think that art form has gone away?
Well, it's gone away by the new things that they have. Some ball clubs don't even take batting practice. All the guys hit underneath the stands. In a cage with the pitching coach sitting there, or they're off to the side and the pitching coach is on a stool throwing a ball and he's hitting it into the net. I mean, it used to be that guys would be around the cage and they'd agitate all the time. I remember Sally Hemus would get up there and he wouldn't swing unless it was a strike, and the guys would say, come on, this ain't base on balls practice, you applehead, and, you know, stuff like that, and then he'd have a comeback, and that's the way it went. And then travel. You know, they get on the planes and they got their computers out and they're going to look at the way they face so-and-so, who's going to pitch against them, or the batters that they go through. And how many times have you seen it during a game? A guy strikes out and he doesn't go back to the bench to talk to the coach. He runs right underneath and looks at the video. I mean, come on. I wouldn't want to look at myself striking out. That'd be a horror movie, for crying out loud.
Who are some of your favorite players who kind of kept the team loose? Because every team seems to have that jokester.
Well, when I was doing Game of the Week, I couldn't wait to talk to Eckersley because he had a whole new language, you know. he'd always give you that. And, of course, Bob Uecker was a delight to be around. Most catchers, believe it or not, most catchers, but managers, they would say, Joe, I got a story for you. And I think, how much time have I got?
You got about 35 seconds.
I can make it. Joe Morgan, the manager of the Red Sox, he told me a story. You know, people don't realize that you have a signal with your first baseman if you have to go out and argue with the first base umpire if the dugout is at third base. And so you run out there, and your first baseman will tell you whether he thought it was safe or out. Umpire calls the guy safe. Joe Morgan goes busting out and looks at his first baseman. First baseman says, I thought he was safe, too. He gave him that signal. Morgan runs right up to the umpire. He says, what'd you call him? He said he was safe. You doggone right he was safe. And turned right around and ran away. I mean, those are the kind of things that happen like that.
Oh, what a great story. And there's lots more in this book. I want you to check out this book. It's so wonderful to read. It'll give you some great insights into baseball like you'll not see anywhere else. It's called Just Play Ball. One of the chapters that I kind of thumbed through a little bit, and I'm looking forward to reading more intensely, is the chapter called Even Charlie Brown's Catcher Would Rather Play the Piano. And I saw the picture of you in there as a catcher. What is it about that position? And I agree with you. I think it's the toughest position on the team. But what is it that makes it that way, Joe?
Well, first of all, you know, forget the nicks that you get from foul tips and all that. But, I mean, Ron, if an infielder misses a ground ball, the outfielder picks it up. If it goes through his legs, the wall stops it. And you as a catcher, you drop a ball, the manager's waiting for you, man. And he's going to let you have it. Now, I'm not talking about the elite catchers, the Yogis, the Campys, the Johnny Benches, and those guys. I'm talking about the grunts. Like I said in the book, and this applies to most catchers, if the catcher was in a dog show, he'd be the fire hydrant. and if he was in a parade, they'd make him march behind the elephants. He said the same view, couldn't say anything, get dumped on the whole time. I mean, that's just the way it is. You've been in press conferences. A guy pitches a good game. What's the first thing that he says? I didn't shake him off one time. Wow, isn't that great praise? And then if a catcher gets hit, look for this. Look for it. If he gets hit, forget that if it's in the vulnerable spot, just gets hit and he's down on his knees, they don't come rushing out. I mean, if you're lucky, the trainer will come out. A pitcher, the star pitcher gets hit, you got everybody coming out. The Red Cross, the bishop comes out, the doctor, MRI. The catcher's laying there, and the umpire will dust off the plate or go get a new ball, like the ball got hurt. I mean, that kind of feeling, and the things that you hear back there is what make it worthwhile, though. We had a play last night where the umpires, they claimed interference. Montero claimed interference. So Melvin comes out and he argues, and I could see him say, ask somebody. So I know exactly what happened. I saw it with Derwood Merrill and Bobby Bragan. These umpires are brilliant, man. Bragan comes out, he says, ask somebody. So he said, all right, I'll ask. He hollered to his third base umpire, did you see that play the way I did? Yeah, that's the way I saw it. That's it. End of argument.
Yeah, in the book, you talk about umpires as well. And Derwood Merrill, you mentioned about him, but there were so many others that over the years, I think, added to the color of the game. Who were some of your favorites, Joe?
Oh, my favorite. Beans Reardon was a favorite. Oh, Beans, he was always moaning because he's a California guy, owned a beer distributorship, and he'd always come out first inning and say, it's hot in St. Louis. I don't want to hear anything. Just catch and shut up. You're lucky you're here. You ought to be selling bananas out of a cart with the rest of your paisanos. So shut up. I mean, that was for openers. And you got that for about nine innings. But the thing that you got from the umpires that I like Luciano, was great. I mean, he would let, and Jocko did the same thing, let the catcher or the batter call the pitch. I mean, Jocko had it with John Roseboro, and if Roseboro held the ball a little longer, it was a ball, in his estimation. And if he threw it right back, it was a strike. So he umpired the game. He just got tired of hearing it. He said, you umpire. Go ahead, you umpire. And he did that to Richie Ashburn. Or how about in Chicago, Jack Sanford's pitching, Ron, and he kept asking for a new ball? You think you'd see an umpire do what Jocko did? He took every ball out of his pocket, rolled it out to the mound, and said, pick one out now.
I love the stories. And Ron Luciano told me about Earl Weaver, that they used to get it on all the time. He said, I threw him out of the game before the game even started. And he said he went into the bathroom that's in the dugout and would not come out.
No. Go in there and smoke. Well, I saw Getz do that to Stanky. and very politely. Gets it, thrown him out of the game the day before, and Stanky hands in the lineup. And as he's walking away, he says to Getz, "And Larry, what I said yesterday still goes." And Larry said, "What'd you say?" He said, "What I said yesterday still goes."